MLK and the Birth of a New Nation, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In 1957, Martin Luther King Jr. headed to West Africa to watch as Ghana achieved independence. King came back inspired.
This was the birth of a new nation.
He wanted to see a model of that kind of transition of power and that real embodiment of freedom. That is absolutely what I think this trip gave him.
Also, a video portal offers people in one Milwaukee neighborhood a global perspective.
Many people in our neighborhood never even left out of the perimeter of the neighborhood. So this was a way to kind of take them out of their worlds into another world in places like Africa and Afghanistan and Germany.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. I will not forget the day. I was in first grade in North Carolina when the news came that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated in Memphis. We were all sent home in the middle of the school day. There were fears there'd be riots. Those fears would later be borne out in cities like Detroit, Trenton, New Jersey, Chicago, and in the nation's capital as well. Today in Washington, hundreds of marchers gathered to remember King's life, his work, and his words.
If you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice. Say that I was a drum major for peace. I was a drum major for righteousness.
As far as I'm concerned, he's a prophet.
That's Ian Uriola, who served as a marshal at the event in D.C. this morning. He's a seminary student in Rochester, New York.
Here at the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, as far as we've come since then, there's still so much work left to do with breaking down walls of systemic racism and racial prejudice. So we do this in his memory and honor to see that dream that he had realized.
A big thanks to WAMU's Michaela Lafrat for getting us that sound. On this, the 50th anniversary of King's death, there's also a lot of speculation. What would have been if King had not been killed? In 1968, he was wrestling with issues of class and race around the Vietnam War and who was fighting America's wars, generally questioning American foreign policy more than ever before. But a decade before that, the global connections to the civil rights movement were just as clear to Dr. King.
Ghana, we now have freedom. Ghana, land of freedom.
1957 was an important year for West Africa. That's when Ghana, or as it had been known then, the Gold Coast, left the colonial clutches of Great Britain and became independent, with a new leader, Kwame Nkrumah.
Kwame, the star of Ghana.
Martin Luther King Jr. saw that transfer of power firsthand. He traveled to Ghana in March 1957, where he attended the independence ceremonies and met Nkrumah. Here he is recounting the moment the British flag was taken down and replaced with Ghana's new flag.
I stood there thinking about so many things. Before I knew it, I started weeping. I was crying for joy. But I knew about all of the struggles and all of the pain and all of the agony that these people had gone through for this moment.
After coming back to the U.S., King spoke about his trip to Ghana during one of his best-known sermons, titled Birth of a New Nation. And the nation he was referring to, it's actually two nations. One is an aspirational United States, where there is justice for all, regardless of color or creed. And the other is literally a new nation, Ghana in West Africa. These were themes that King went on to incorporate into his larger civil rights message over the years.
I think the fact that he went to not only Nkrumah's inauguration, but Akizwe's in Nigeria in 1960, that he has been deeply inspired by the independence movements in Africa. And that the fact that he went twice to Africa before the Great March on Washington is an important fact that is not often remembered.
This is Jocelyn Janine Luckett. She's with the Africana Studies Department at the University of Pennsylvania. So I want to know more about this trip and how it impacted Dr. King. But just remind us, first of all, what was happening in King's world in the South on the eve of his departure for Ghana? Because this is in March of 1957.
That's right. And we often think of the Montgomery bus boycott as happening in 1955, which is when it started. But it went until late December of 56. And so this moment when he's about to leave for Ghana is really only weeks after the boycott ends. And what's happening in Alabama is that there's terrible violence. King is writing repeatedly to President Eisenhower to say, you've got to come to Alabama. Pregnant women are being shot. Snipers are attacking black and white folks on buses in Montgomery. It's a time of racial terror for sure, right before he's getting on the plane to Ghana.
So what a contrast to go from that whole scene in the South in Alabama over to this joyous scene in Accra in Ghana. What was the scene there? Because there were lots of dignitaries from all over Africa who were in attendance, not to mention African-American notables as well, right?
I know. That's one of the most amazing things, that he's seeing the ambassador of Liberia. He's seeing Americans like Ralph Bunche, Adam Clayton Powell, A. Philip Randolph, to see all of those folks in one place and to be really, you know, the young lion kind of in that crew. For him, I think, as such a young man still in his 20s, had to have been tremendous for him.
Well, let's listen to a bit of his Birth of a New Nation sermon after returning from the Gold Coast. And he's actually describing the scene in Accra after this independence ceremony on March 6th.
We could hear little children, 6 years old, and old people, 80 and 90 years old, walking the streets of Accra, crying, freedom, freedom. And I could hear that old Negro spiritual once more crying out, free at last, great God Almighty, I'm free at last. They were experiencing that in their very souls. Freedom, freedom.
Wow. Well, we can hear free at last, that those lines would come up later in his life. Why do you think Dr. King wanted to be there in Ghana?
What's so moving about this moment, I think, is that he's emphasizing that they were experiencing freedom. And so you really have a sense at that moment that Dr. King has not yet felt a feeling of freedom. And I think must wonder, when will African-Americans get to also experience, the way he stretches out that word, experience freedom. So I think that he wanted to see a model. I mean, to see a model of that kind of transition of power and that real embodiment of freedom. That is absolutely what I think this trip gave him.
So the Gold Coast was the first sub-Saharan African country to gain independence. What impacted Dr. King the most about his visit? Like in the long run, what really moved him?
Well, I think, again, the idea that it was a nonviolent transition of power, I think that's radical for him.
And it's a beautiful thing, isn't it? That here is a nation that is now free, and it is free without rising up with arms and with ammunition. It is free through nonviolent means.
But also the struggle for the people of the Gold Coast and then Ghana to fight to get the freedom. He emphasizes that so much later in the speech.
The oppressor never voluntarily gives freedom to the oppressed.
And you hear that as a really pointed message, I think, to the congregation in Montgomery, that this fight will continue and must continue as a fully embodied fight and struggle.
Freedom only comes through persistent revolt, through persistent agitation, through persistently rising up against the system of evil. And don't sit down and do nothing now, because the buses are integrated. Because if you stop now, we will be in the dungeons of segregation and discrimination for another 100 years.
There's a little detail that Dr. King mentioned in that struggle, in that fight, that Kwame Nkrumah, who became prime minister at that point, was engaged in. He noticed that when Nkrumah came out on the dais, he was wearing his prison cap. But there weren't any crowns. He wasn't a king. He was a man.
Yeah, I love that. I love that moment in the speech where he talks about wearing the prison cap. You know, really, it reminds me then, that connects me to the SNCC workers, always wearing sort of the workers' overalls.
The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Exactly, yeah. that it was not a movement of elites by any means. It was workers, it was prisoners, you know. So this is a really powerful symbol, I think.
I'm curious to know what other lessons King took away from his visit to Ghana, and like how often did he reference in other sermons or even just in his daily fight this visit to Ghana and what post-colonial independence meant to him?
Right. You know, not only did he go back to Nigeria for that inauguration in 60, but he works to bring African students to black colleges, for example, and he does fundraisers for other African leaders who come through the states. So his connection and eye on Africa is really important. And I also want to say that in terms of the sort of diaspora and the diasporic circuits, it's important to remember actually that Nkrumah came to study in the U.S. in Philadelphia at Lincoln University and then also University of Pennsylvania. So these circuits of these African independence leaders, both them coming to the U.S., but then also our leaders going there, is an often, I think, neglected aspect of the Freedom Revolution, how they are absolutely connected on both sides of the Atlantic.
Now, HBO is currently airing a really fascinating documentary called King in the Wilderness, which focuses on the last few years of King's life. It also shows a schism between Dr. King and Stokely Carmichael, the head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Now, Carmichael was very black power. We don't need or want whites to be part of our struggle. And interestingly, would later go into exile first in Ghana and then in Guinea in West Africa after the FBI targeted him in the U.S. King, on the other hand, saw this very all-African, all-black ceremony of independence in Ghana in 57, and it so inspired him. But why do you think it didn't push King toward the kind of vision Stokely Carmichael had for African-American liberation? Because that would seem to be the natural destination for those ideas.
Right. That's a great and complicated question. I think that if you look at King's writings, you really see a man deeply struggling with the ideas of black power. He sees many benefits to kind of notions of black power. And clearly, I would then connect that back to the black power that he saw in 1957. So there is a connection. I think King ultimately felt, though, in the U.S. context, to say sort of an exclusively black movement was not going to be one that would be sustainable. It would have been too threatening to be only a black movement. It's also important that, you know, King is always been a global person, global, interfaith, interracial. I mean, all of those ideas of pluralism are crucial for King. So I think that, again, stands in counter with the idea of only a black power movement.
Jocelyn Janine Luckett with the Africana Studies Department at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Martin Luther King Jr.'s funeral was held on April 9th, 1968. Noted civil rights movement photographer Flip Schulke was there, and we have some of his photos over at PRI.org. And we'll have more on MLK later in the show. Just ahead, the world's Rupa Shenoy connects the dots between Martin Luther King Jr. and the 2020 U.S. Census. And later, we'll hear a speech by Dr. King that was recorded during his 1959 trip to India. In it, King praised his role model, the late Indian civil rights leader Mahatma Gandhi.
Now he belongs to the ages. And if this age is to survive, it must follow the way of love and nonviolence that he so nobly illustrated in his life. And Mahatma Gandhi may well be God's appeal to this generation.
Those stories and more coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. We're hearing a lot of different perspectives today about Martin Luther King Jr. on this, the 50th anniversary of his death. But I doubt anyone's connected King to the 2020 census. That's what The World's Rupa Shenoy has done, by looking at some of King's final words in light of where we stand today.
Exactly a year to the day before Dr. King died, April 4th, he laid out an expanded dream, one where oppressed and poor people around the world advocated for each other.
A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of South America and say this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just.
That was a powerful message to send across the world as many countries were struggling to emerge from colonialism. King enhanced the American image as the vanguard of freedom. Millions began immigrating to the U.S., a demographic shift that King never got to see. The year he died, a daughter of Caribbean immigrants became the first black woman elected to the U.S. Congress.
We are entering a new era in which we must, as Americans, demand stature.
Shirley Chisholm represented her diverse Brooklyn district fiercely, going door to door as a census taker in 1970, speaking Spanish to make sure her Latino constituents weren't undercounted as they were elsewhere. 2 years later, as the first black person and woman to run for president, Chisholm made a point of advocating for people who'd been ignored.
You take the Chicana people in the southwestern part of this country. These people work in sometimes 14 and 15 hours a day. And at the end of a week, they don't even get a decent salary to keep their families together.
A decade later, the Rainbow Coalition in Chicago elected the city's first black mayor, and they did it by bringing together a never-before-seen coalition of Latinos, blacks, and liberal whites. Mayor Harold Washington, a Chicago native, was beloved.
I'm the result of 400-some-odd years of struggle, serfdom, man's inhumanity to man. When people cry for help, whether they're Chinese coolies or South African Bantu, or serfs in Russia, or South African held in bondage, or gay and lesbians pushed around, that I'll be there and defending them and supporting them. That's just no big deal.
You know, I would say that Barack Obama stood on Harold Washington's shoulders.
One of Washington's advisors, David Axelrod, speaking there to the local ABC TV news, went on to help lead Barack Obama's successful campaigns for president.
Had Harold Washington not been elected mayor in 1983, I don't know that the political conditions would have been there for Barack Obama to rise in Illinois politics the way he did.
Like Washington, Obama was supported by a diverse coalition. Civil rights attorney Steve Phillips published a book about that in early 2016 called Brown is the New White. He argued Obama's election was proof that minorities, immigrants, black people, and liberal whites had already formed a new national majority that was a powerful political force. So what happened to that coalition? This year, Phillips reissued his book with a new preface that answers that question.
What happened in 2016 is there was an element of splintering and lack of motivation, which allowed Trump to slide through in terms of Trump being able to actually get in.
And the Trump administration came in with hostile rhetoric and policies toward communities of color.
And this is not without historical precedent, right? This is very similar to what happened after the Civil War, where you had the Reconstruction efforts, which were then abandoned. And so what the election of Trump is akin to the destruction of Reconstruction.
The country is a lot more diverse now than it was then. I've always wondered if Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders thought that would make a difference. After all, their movement pushed for the sweeping 1965 legislation that lifted restrictions on immigration. But Miller says there aren't any records to show that's true. Regardless,
the demographic revolution is inexorable and irreversible. So that's the engine of change within this country.
There are people who dispute that idea that there's a growing number of minorities who will vote together, even though the Census Department in the last years of the Obama administration projected the country will become, quote, minority-majority in 2044. An earlier census director doesn't buy it.
I do not think the country is about to become majority-minority.
Kenneth Pruitt led the Census Bureau during the Clinton administration.
And here's why I do not think that is going to be true. because very large percentages of some of the so-called minorities are migrating to the white race. That's the box they're ticking.
Pruitt says there's information that shows, for example, that more affluent Asian Americans who marry European Americans are more likely to report their children as white than Asian.
That's the same thing that happened in the 1890s, 1910s, and so forth.
There was an influx of European immigrants then, and Pruitt says there was an option on the census for white people to identify more specifically as, for example, Italian, Irish, or Polish. He says records show immigrants checked those boxes, but their sons and daughters were more likely to identify as white. Pruitt thinks that's what'll happen with the current generations of immigrants and their children.
And so that's just going to happen. That's the history of this country.
The results of the 2020 census may show to what extent he's right. Because while the government stopped asking white people about their national origins in the 1920s, the question's coming back. Under an Obama administration proposal approved by the Trump administration, white and black people will be asked for their national origins on the 2020 census. Steve Phillips, the brown is the new white guy, hopes someone will motivate a coalition of minorities to regroup and identify with each other. But he says that would take diverse political leadership, and people who lead the Democratic Party and control its resources are still mostly white.
That's the question before the country now. Is that coalition able to come back together again and come out and participate in a way which will take back power?
Phillips points out that two-thirds of Asian Americans didn't vote for Trump, and he doesn't think the Trump administration is making an effort to reach out to them or other groups of color.
So the opportunity remains significant for reassembling the coalition that is, in fact, the majority.
So here we are, 50 years after King's death, with America in limbo. It seems like the country's poised on the verge of either following through on a modern version of King's final dream or defying it.
We are now faced with the fact, my friends, that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now.
51 years ago today, King told his audience, there is such a thing as being too late. For the world, Rupa Shenoy.
Rupa is the host of our Otherhood podcast. Subscribe to it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom. It's a fact of life. Attorneys are expensive. You're likely to pay around $300 an hour. That's just one reason why smart business owners turn to LegalZoom. In fact, over 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom to start their businesses with LLCs, incorporation, and more. But even after your business is set up, LegalZoom can still help you out with things like lease agreements, changing tax laws, and contract reviews. LegalZoom created their business legal plan to help you get legal advice for your business from vetted, independent attorneys and tax professionals available in every state. You also receive access to NDAs, lease agreements, and more. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour, since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Instead, you just pay one low upfront price. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan today and get special savings when you visit LegalZoom.com/world. LegalZoom, where life meets legal.
I'm Marco Werman. President Trump often baffles people with his pronouncements. Yesterday's statement about using the military to guard the Mexican border was no exception.
The governors had not been notified. Mexico had not been notified, nor had, for all we can tell, the Department of Homeland Security, which has tens of thousands of agents securing the border.
More on that still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Here's a familiar tune. White House aides have had to walk back some tough talk from the commander-in-chief. Yesterday, Trump told reporters that his administration would use the U.S. military to guard the border with Mexico. Then later, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders clarified that comment. Sanders said Trump actually meant to say he'd mobilize the National Guard. a big difference and one that's not lost on Juliette Kayyem. She was an assistant secretary of Homeland Security under President Barack Obama. Kayyem says restrictions on using the military troops for civilian law enforcement are in part what separates democracies from totalitarian states.
When the president said that he was going to send the military at the border, there was rightfully a lot of concern about what was happening. At best, with this correction late at night, you can say the president was confused. At worst, you can say that the president of the United States does not understand the difference between active military, law enforcement, and the National Guard. In this country, because of the Posse Comitatus Act, it's a Civil War era act, which basically prohibits active military serving as a law enforcement entity, we essentially do not allow the military to be used as a civilian enforcement entity.
Just elaborate a little further why you see that as a difference between democracy and authoritarianism.
After the Civil War, the active military were utilized essentially to be deployed to harass, harm, isolate freed slaves in the South. And so the Posse Comitatus Act, which is essentially a prohibition, said the active military under the commander-in-chief cannot be used for law enforcement purposes. There are some exceptions, like in the case of an insurrection, but for the most part, it's an important distinction. The National Guard here in the United States is a different military entity. It serves under governors. National Guard members are not subject to the Posse Comitatus Act, but they act under and only under the direction of the governor.
So is Trump essentially ordering states along the border, those governors, to send their National Guard out?
No, and that's what was so confusing about it. The governors had not been notified. Mexico had not been notified, nor had, for all we can tell, the Department of Homeland Security, which has tens of thousands of agents securing the border. Imagine sending active military down to what is residential civilian area. What would be the optics, and what are the rules of engagement? Are they allowed to shoot? I mean, it's so mad that the Pentagon quickly put the president in his place. But the other scary thing is, here's Mexico sitting there thinking, are you kidding me? They're going to send active military at our border. Are they coming into the country? You know, we don't do that, right? But one more thing, Marco, I want to say, you know, we have this idea of thinking of the border as something that has to be fortified. It's worth reminding people that a million people a week now, I think, cross the Mexican-U.S. border.
And just on a regular basis, commuting.
And that doesn't even include trade and goods and all the other activities that are at a border that has to, by design, be porous.
The idea of using the National Guard on the border is not new. President Obama had 1,200 National Guard troops there, and President Bush sent 6,000. Just remind us briefly why they sent those National Guard forces to the border, and did they make a difference?
It's hard to know whether they make a difference. In fact, those of us who have worked on these sort of, you know, more domestic efforts, I think the jury is out. But those were both in response to immediate needs. In particular, President Obama sent the National Guard because of essentially a mass migration through a border that could not be controlled. If you look at the data now, unlawful crossings on the Mexican-U.S. border are down to an almost minimum, and there is a lot of enforcement at the border. So I suspect that the president will probably request for some of the governors to send their military down. But that's the best he can do. He can only ask them to utilize their National Guard at the border.
So are you saying there's really not much for the National Guard to do along the border?
I think for a show of force, and I don't mean this in a bad way, sometimes I think security theater is a good thing if you actually have an imminent threat, whether it's a mass migration or drugs or for a period of time, which is what both presidents did when they did deploy the National Guard. But a steady state, what the National Guard can do is help law enforcement in terms of training and support capacity. But we have a Customs and Border Patrol and local law enforcement for a reason. It's because the border is not militarized. It is because it is about flow and commercial activity as much as it is about a wall.
Juliette, you've had nearly 15 months now to get accustomed to Trump's impulses and the directives that flow from those impulses. How real does this one feel?
There was a lot of friends of mine who were really scared by what the president said, and I tweeted out, because that's my form of communication, the Pentagon will walk this back in 5, 4, 3, and about 5 hours later, the Pentagon walked it back. I think if you have fear about what this is about, it is about we have a commander-in-chief now well into a year of his rule who does not know the basic distinctions of military authority.
Juliette Kayyem was an assistant secretary of Homeland Security under President Obama. We're going to move now from our southern border to our northern one. The U.S. exports a lot to Canada: cell phones, cars, computers, even drug policy. Mandatory minimum sentencing is common for drug offenses in the U.S. Half of the people serving time in federal prisons here are serving mandatory minimums. A few years ago, the Canadian government decided to follow America's lead. In our special series from our Across Women's Lives team, we investigate how that policy is impacting women in Canada. From Toronto, the world's Andrea Crossan has our story.
On June 27th of 2015, Cheyenne Sharma landed here at Pearson International Airport. She arrived on a flight from Trinidad. She was stopped by Canada's Border Services Agency. Border agents inspected her suitcase and found more than 4 pounds of cocaine in the lining. Cheyenne Sharma was arrested. She admitted that she'd been offered $20,000 to transport the suitcase. Before we go any further, do you think you know enough about Cheyenne Sharma? What do you think her sentence should be? Here's what the law says. The mandatory minimum sentence in Canada for trafficking cocaine is 2 years. The maximum sentence is life.
What's going to happen tomorrow is Cheyenne Sharma is going to be sentenced by Justice Casey Hill at the Superior Court.
That's one of Cheyenne's lawyers, Jonathan Rudin, speaking to me last month. He's the program director of Aboriginal Legal Services in Toronto. Cheyenne's legal team is challenging Canada's mandatory minimum sentencing as being unconstitutional. Jonathan Rudin is hoping that Cheyenne Sharma's case will change the law across Canada. And to do this, he's putting the country's entire colonial history on trial.
Canada developed a policy, an explicit policy, to destroy Aboriginal people as a people. They used a number of mechanisms to do that. The most notorious now is the residential school system.
Jonathan Rudin says that these schools are the source of much of the economic and educational disadvantage that Indigenous Canadians face today. Residential schools were government-funded and run by religious orders. From the 1870s through to the 1990s, over 150,000 Indigenous children were removed from their families and educated in these schools. Children weren't allowed to speak their Indigenous language or practice their beliefs.
The residential school system was designed to kill the Indian and the child, which was the government's terms. And the idea was, after residential school, there would be no Indians because they would all be assimilated.
The government spent over 100 years trying to destroy Indigenous culture. And to a great extent, it worked. The system led to generations of families broken apart. So what does this have to do with Cheyenne Sharma? The 23-year-old is Ojibwe and a member of the Saugeen Nation, and a product of this devastating history. Her short life has been filled with trauma. Some that I'll tell you about, some that I won't. And it's not that big of a leap, Jonathan Rudin argues, to find someone with that kind of personal history getting off that plane with that suitcase.
While we think of jail in this country as a place where people go, in fact, it's a place where a particular set of people go. And for women, it's a place where beyond disproportionately, Indigenous women go.
The numbers are staggering. While Indigenous women make up about 3% of the population of women in Canada, they make up 38% of women in prison.
I think there's no other group in the Canadian context right now that is experiencing the effects of Canadian racism than Indigenous women.
That's York University sociology professor Carmela Murdaka. Murdaka says that colonialism is alive and well in Canada.
That version of colonialism is not a historical event that happened in the past, but is a structure that continues to endure in Indigenous people's lives.
Carmela Murdaka testified on behalf of Cheyenne's defense.
Socioeconomic disadvantage, different educational opportunities for Indigenous people, the legacies that we know emerged from experiences of residential schools and the intergenerational trauma, all of those factors tend to bring Indigenous people, and Indigenous women in particular, into more frequent contact with the criminal justice system.
So back to Cheyenne's life. Here's just some of the things that we know about her from the court documents. When Cheyenne's grandmother was a child, she was taken to one of those government-run residential schools. Cheyenne's mother was in foster care for a period of time. Cheyenne herself is a rape survivor.
She ran away from home at 13. At 16, she attempted suicide. And again at 17. At 18, she had her daughter. She has lived in poverty all of her 23 years. At the time of her arrest, she and her daughter were about to be evicted from their home. Before tougher legislation was enacted in 2012, a judge could take all of this information into account and give Cheyenne a conditional sentence, one which she could serve in the community. Now the minimum Cheyenne could receive would be 2 years plus a day, which would be served in a federal prison. The prosecution is asking for a 3.5-year sentence. It's a mix of snow and wet rain falling outside of the Brampton Superior Courthouse on the morning of Cheyenne's sentencing. One of her defense lawyers, Rob Christie, is gulping down a large coffee in the cafeteria and waiting for his client to arrive. He's hopeful that the judge will lift the mandatory minimum and maybe even give Cheyenne that conditional sentence.
Mandatory minimum sentences and putting shackles on judges doesn't get you justice. You get cookie-cutter results.
And he says it's not drug kingpins being prosecuted, that it's drug mules like Cheyenne.
Typically, importers are lied to and manipulated and controlled. And we grab them and we don't even try to go the next step, to up the ladder.
While we're talking, a young woman approaches us. She's got long, straight, candy floss pink hair. She says hi to Rob and stands next to us with a shy smile.
Hey, Cheyenne.
Hey, Dan.
It's Cheyenne. Rob needs to talk to her before her sentencing, so I put away my microphone. The two confer briefly, and then it's time to go to the courtroom. When we get there, Cheyenne sits down next to me in the back row. She has these beautiful nails, long manicured. They're painted kind of a bluey purple. I ask if she got any sleep last night. She tells me only a couple of hours. Cheyenne Sharma places her bag and her coat on the floor next to my feet. She joins Rob Christie and Jonathan Rudin at the front of the courtroom. The judge enters the court. Now remember, the mandatory minimum sentence is 2 years and a day. But Cheyenne's team has argued minimum sentences shouldn't apply and she should receive a conditional sentence. The judge reads a summary of his sentence to a hushed courtroom. In it, Justice Casey Hill calls the mandatory minimum cruel and unusual punishment for Indigenous offenders caught up in a, quote, tragic history within the criminal justice system. And just like that, the law is changed. The mandatory minimum sentence is struck down. Cheyenne's case has changed Canadian law. But Cheyenne's not going home. Justice Hill still sentences her to 17 months in prison. There's a moment after the judge leaves when no one moves. It's like the air has been sucked out of the room. And then Cheyenne asks Rob Christie if she can go and get her belongings. She walks to the back of the courtroom. I hand her the bag and her coat. And then she's taken away by two police officers. So back to that question I had for you. Do you think you know enough about Cheyenne Sharma? And more importantly,
would people have empathy for Cheyenne Sharma?
Jonathan Rudin again.
In the abstract, if you just say, here's an Indigenous woman, she was charged with importing drugs, people would probably say, yeah, well, she should go to jail. Everyone who imports drugs should go to jail. We shouldn't treat people any differently. If they actually knew about her life, if they knew what she had been through, if she knew what her family had been through, then I really do think people's attitudes would change. But without that information, then no.
The Canadian government has been talking about scrapping mandatory minimum sentencing as it relates to other drug offenses, but so far has failed to do so. Cheyenne Sharma will be eligible for parole this summer. For The World, I'm Andrea Crossan, Toronto.
Tomorrow, our series continues. We'll visit a prison in Mexico where children are raised behind bars.
Está viendo la tele y sale, pasan 40 minutos de noticia. Van a llevar a la.
You'll be watching TV, the news, and they'll talk about someone who's being sent to Santa Marta prison, and he'll say, we live there. And he'll ask, why do we live here?
Mothers and children serving time together. That's tomorrow here on The World. In all the discussion today about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we'd like to add one more note. King was the son and grandson of Baptist preachers, but another role model was Mahatma Gandhi. In fact, King frequently mentioned Gandhi as a guiding light. Here's King in 1963. He was speaking at a news conference produced by the government-run U.S. Information Agency for broadcast overseas, and it starts with a question from a correspondent for Indian Express.
Dr. King, to what extent have you patterned your movement on the struggle waged by Mr. Gandhi in India? And to what extent is struggle of the American Negro part of the worldwide movement for freedom?
To answer the last part of the question first, I would say that our movement here in the United States is in a real sense a part of a worldwide struggle to break down the barriers of injustice and oppression. It is not an isolated or detached struggle, but it is a part of this worldwide struggle for freedom and human dignity. Now, on the first part of the question, I would say that our movement has been patterned after the Gandhian movement in India a great deal. Some years ago, when I first studied the Gandhian philosophy and the method of nonviolent resistance, I came to the conclusion that it was the most potent weapon available to oppress people in their struggle for freedom and human dignity.
A few years before that, King had visited India with his wife and biographer. It was 1959, and at the airport, King told reporters that he was there not as a tourist, but as a pilgrim. He never met Gandhi, who had been killed in 1948, but while he was in India, King did meet some of Gandhi's relatives. And in a speech for Indian radio, King had this to say about Gandhi.
Now he belongs to the ages, and if this age is to survive, it must follow the way of love and nonviolence that he so nobly illustrated in his life. And Mahatma Gandhi may well be God's appeal to this generation, for in a day when Sputniks and explorers dash through outer space and guided ballistic missiles are carving highways of death through the stratosphere, no nation can win a war. Today we no longer have a choice between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. there, speaking about one of his beacons of nonviolence, Mahatma Gandhi. And finally today, keep your eyes peeled for tricked-out shipping containers popping up in places like Iraq, Germany, Rwanda, Mexico, and here in the U.S. They're actually art installations, and the world's Lydia Jean Cott decided to check them out.
I meet Lewis Lee on the west side of Chicago on a blustery Saturday afternoon. He's standing in front of a gold, spray-painted shipping container. It's called a portal, and Lewis is a portal curator. It's hard to tell because of the wind, but I think his portal's making noises.
Are the sounds coming from the
portal? Yeah, they're actually in Mexico.
Should we go in?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, watch.
I dust off my boots and step inside. There's a huge screen.
Hi.
And on it, there's a 25-year-old guy with shaggy hair waving at me from Mexico. His name is Samuel Ordonez, and he's a portal curator, just like Lewis, welcoming people off the street into his portal in Mexico City.
I'm going to open my door and see if there's some people coming, okay?
Okay, cool.
As you can hear, the audio connection is fuzzy, but that doesn't get in the way. Here's Lewis.
So what we do daily is, like, these are how the connections start. These are how, like, the friendship starts.
All sorts of people wander into the Mexico City portal and appear on our screen in Chicago. Lewis and I speak to a couple of Texan tourists.
Hola.
Hey.
We're from Texas. We're in Mexico City.
College student.
Nice bag.
And a wide-eyed girl who came with her parents and initially seems too shy to talk.
Hola. Hola.
But then gives it a go. Lewis is big and burly, and these global conversations, they make him light up. Lewis got involved with portals 2 years ago when he was working as a community organizer in the Amani neighborhood of Milwaukee, which is where he lives. And he ended up on this strange phone call.
When they first told us about the portal, we were thinking they were in the business of making portal potties. And I'm thinking, like, why would I want to talk to people while I'm in a porta potty.
Still, Lewis's neighborhood needed all the help it could get. It had been leading Milwaukee in homicides for years. It had the highest incarceration rate in the country. So the golden box arrived, and Lewis set it up in front of his daughter's high school, thinking maybe the kids would like it, and it would help keep them out of trouble. But soon, it wasn't just the kids who were using the portal, but adults, too.
I think it started to, how can I say, open the eyes of the residents in the neighborhood. Many people in our neighborhood never even left out of the perimeter of the neighborhood. So this was a way to kind of take them out of their worlds into another world in places like Africa and Afghanistan and Germany.
Lewis says the portal changed things for Imani, a majority black neighborhood.
People started to come out and kind of rally around this machine. And I think it gave pride back to our neighborhood to have something so cutting edge in a neighborhood that's known for bad things. We started to kind of change the stigma of being the most incarcerated zip code to the most innovative zip code, if you know what I mean.
The portal also had an unexpected impact on Lewis.
It kind of just helped me to deal with traumas that I was going through, believe it or not.
When Lewis was 18, he was shot 5 times during a stick-up. His younger brother was killed the week before. Talking to people who had lived in war zones in Afghanistan and Syria helped him make sense of his own life.
Even though they were halfway across the world, it was like we were going through the same type of things, facing the same type of traumas.
Now Lewis does this full-time. Since the Milwaukee portal was such a success, he's in charge of launching the new portal I visited in Chicago. This whole thing is run through an organization called Shared Studios that was founded by 2 former journalists named Amar Bakshi and Michelle Machador. They used to be foreign correspondents. Michelle says that she feels like what they do now is not so different.
As journalists, we tell stories, and I think this is another way of doing so, you know, placing people in situations where they're able to create their own meaning themselves.
And Lewis tells me his story has gone in a direction that he never thought it would go.
Talking to people, it made me anxious to want to see what it was like to be in certain parts of the world. So I kind of overcame my fear of flying.
I didn't know you used to be afraid of flying.
Yes, I was terrified. But now I'm like airplane junkie.
This summer, Lewis will make his first trip abroad to Kenya. For The World, I'm Lydia Jean Cott.
While Lydia Jean was working on that story, our partners here at WGBH were talking to Shared Studios separately about a possible collaboration. And it turns out we're going to have our own portal right here later this month. That is going to be cool. That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.